At 2 p.m. on this very day, throughout all of the United States, bells of all shapes, sizes, and sounds will ring. 200 years ago today at approximately 2 o'clock our time, delegates to the Grand Convention in Philadelphia started queuing up to sign their proposed Constitution of the United States. It would still require 9 months before it could really be called a Constitution. This happened on June 21st of 1788 when New Hampshire, the ninth state, ratified it. During that hot and humid summer of 1787, the delegates labored nearly 4 months in a stuffy building with windows closed most of the time to prevent their words from being heard by the outside world during their deliberations. You from the East Coast know what it is even with air conditioning. I can't imagine what it would be with windows closed in a small, stuffy room. Tempers would flare. Some delegates would go home early. Compromise and crisis would take place. Yet on September 17th, 1787, they signed a document that it is now the oldest written constitution of its kind in the world. It has served nearly 457 million Americans to date, 247 million of whom are alive today. Now, was it possible that these delegates, living in the 18th century rural society, could write a constitution that would effectively serve 247 million people living in the 20th century in this space age? What did they know that writers of hundreds of other constitutions since have not known? Was there something unique about its creation or the men who wrote it? Many of the delegates realized the importance of what they were doing. Benjamin Franklin had said that if the convention failed, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate incident, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, or conquest. Possibly this is the reason, in spite of ill health and personal suffering, that he attended the convention. Another delegate, Rufus King, said that his fears were more agitated for his country than he could express, that he conceived this to be the last opportunity of providing for a liberty and happiness for the people. Madison had also said at the beginning of the convention that the delegates were now digesting a plan which in its operation would decide forever the fate of Republican government. Hamilton had written in the Federalist Papers, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved for the people of this country, by their conduct and example, to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from the reflection and choice, or whether they would forever be destined to depend on their political constitutions, on accident and force." Certainly their recent experience with the British and with the Articles of Confederation would have led to this concern. But it still doesn't answer the question of how they were able to write our Constitution. I believe our prophet, Ezra Taft Benson, put his finger on the answer when he said in an address given here at Brigham Young University, "It would be erroneous for us, however, to conclude that the document was the sole genius of the founding fathers. Theirs was a combined wisdom derived from heavenly inspiration, knowledge of political governments from past ages, and the crucible of their own experience. Inspiration, knowledge, and experience. For our purpose today, let us start by looking at some of the delegates, who they were, and what was their background and experience and knowledge. Thomas Jefferson had said of the convention after he heard who the delegates were, that it was an assembly of demigods. John Adams has also written, "The deliberate union was so great and various a people in such a place as this, without particular or prejudice, if not the greatest exertion of human understanding, the greatest single effort of a national deliberation that the world has ever seen." And Everett Wilson, writing in his book, The Constitution of the United States and the Bulwark of Liberty, states, "The American system was devised by the ablest group of men who ever appeared at the same time in the same country throughout all the history of the world. Just as the former times produced masterpieces in science and commercial organization, so the architects of the American plan of a self-disciplined liberty produced a masterpiece of free government." Now, who were these 55 men who in varying degrees were the framers of our national constitution? The knowledge concerning some of them is indefinite, but the following facts, I think, are substantially correct. All of them except eight were natives of the colonies. Franklin was the oldest at 81. Dayton, the youngest, was 26. 14 were over 50. 21 were less than 40. 25 were college men. These men were almost without exception acquainted with public affairs. 46 had been members of one or both of the houses of the colonial or state legislatures. 10 had attended state constitutional conventions. 16 had been governors or would be governors or presidents of states. In national affairs, 42 were delegates to the Continental Congress. 8 were signers of the Declaration of Independence. 6 were signers of the draft of the Articles of Confederation. 7 had attended the Annapolis Convention. And 3 had been executive officers under the Congress. Two future presidents of the United States took a prominent part in the proceedings of the convention, and one future vice president. Two others were to be candidates for the vice presidency. The position of which these men occupied, or were later to fulfill, marked the regard in which they were held by their fellow citizens, in their character and in their worth. The most important man in the convention, of course, was George Washington. Indeed, his acceptance of the deputyship, made reluctantly after long consideration, was the initial triumph of the movement and a foreshadowing of success, so great was his prestige in the colonies. Madison and Randolph, his fellow deputies from Virginia, were very active in the work of the convention. Madison's great knowledge of political science, the fact that to him, more than any of the other deputies, public life was a profession, and his grasp of the essential problems before the convention and the means by which they could be solved, enabled him to become the principal architect of the Constitution. Franklin was the seer of the convention. His great age and the infirmities he was suffering made it difficult for him to have active participation, and he was probably responsible for little of the detailed results. But his very presence gave importance and dignity, and his advice must have been eagerly and actively sought after and carefully considered. He and Washington were the two great harmonizers. Washington presided over the formal sessions, taking little part in the debate. But in the committee of the whole and in the private conferences, which was the important underpinning of the formal structure as it arose, he was in constant consultation with his colleagues. Also, as the character of the plan developed, there was general recognition of the fact that he must be the leading man in the early operation of the new government, and this of necessity influenced its shape. Years after the convention, James Madison had written of them, "I feel it a duty to express my profound and solemn conviction, derived from my intimate opportunity of observing and appreciating the views of the convention, collectively and individually, that there was never an assembly of men charged with so great and arduous trust who were more pure in their motives or more exclusively or anxiously devoted to the object committed to them than were the members of the Federal Convention of 1787. They were extremely knowledgeable of government and had gained considerable experience as a result of serving in their various states. Some 23 of the signers had served in the war for independence and were intimately familiar with the deprivation and suffering caused by the lack of a strong union and a weak central government. George Washington had served 8 years as the commander and understood better than most this need. Even those who hadn't felt the direct effects of a weak and inefficient government at Valley Forge, Morristown, New York, or other battle sites, had witnessed the deteriorating state of their republic after the war, commerce problems, rebellion, inflation caused by the printing of money. This was enough to convince even the most ardent supporters of the Articles of Confederation that something had to be done to render the Articles effective to the needs of the people in this day. Their individual and collective experience gained from the war and their involvement in state and national governments would help. Some had helped write their state constitutions, but they needed even more, an understanding of what had been tried in the past and what other ideas and opinions and options were available to them in that day. Most of the delegates were ardent students of government and had read exclusively on the subject. In fact, during the previous 2 decades, America had been awash with political tracts and writings on government and liberty. It is of deep interest to me to find the major source of the ideas for the Constitution. 2 professors made a diligent study, Donald S. Lutz and Charles S. Heineman. They reviewed some estimated 15,000 items and closely read 2,200 books, pamphlets, newspaper articles, and monographs with explicitly political content printed between 1760 and 1805. From these items, they identified 3,154 references to other sources in our Constitution. The source most oftenly cited by the Founding Fathers was the Bible, which accounted for 34% of all citations. Heavy emphasis on biblical law was referred to frequently. The most cited thinkers were not deists and philosophers, but legal and political thinkers who were also Christian. We have so far reviewed 2 elements mentioned by President Benson, experience and knowledge. What about heavenly inspiration? Did any of the delegates attribute the writing of the Constitution to inspiration? The challenge before the delegates at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was how to protect the individual's basic rights and at the same time provide for a union. Before the convention started, even George Washington, who was elected president of the convention, had his doubts. He said, "It is probable that no plan we propose will be adopted. Perhaps another dreadful conflict will be sustained. If to please the people, we offer what we ourselves disapprove, how can we afterwards defend our work? Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God." A year later, the day after Massachusetts ratified the Constitution, Washington would write to another friend, Lafayette, of the miraculous nature of their efforts. He wrote, "It appears to me a little short of a miracle that the delegates from so many different states, in their manners, circumstances, and prejudices, should unite in forming a system of national government." As President George Washington also said, "The hand of Providence has been so conspicuous in all of this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith, and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations." Many of the other delegates also recognized divine inspiration in their work. Writing in the Federalist Papers, James Madison, often referred to as the father of the Constitution, wrote, "It would be impossible for a man of pious reflection not to perceive in it the finger of that almighty hand which has so frequently and signally extended our relief in the critical states of the Revolution." Alexander Hamilton, famous for the originator of the Federalist Papers, an author of 51 of those, said, "For my own part, I sincerely esteem it a system which without the finger of God never could have been suggested or agreed upon by such a diversity of interests." Benjamin Franklin, on April 8th of 1788, said, "I have so much faith in the general government of the world by Providence that I can hardly conceive a transaction of such momentous importance to the welfare of millions now existing and to exist in the posterity of a great nation should be suffered to pass without being in some degree influenced, guided, and governed by that omnipotent, omnipresent, and beneficent ruler in whom all inferior spirits live and move and have their being." Such comments have not been limited to delegates themselves, but others have studied the events concerned as well. Daniel Webster, a noted defender of the Constitution, although not a delegate, said in 1837, "I regard it, the Constitution, as the work of the purest patriots and the wisest statesmen that ever existed, aired by the smile of a benign providence. It almost appears a divine interposition in our behalf. The hand that destroys our Constitution renders our Union asunder forever." And even if we look today to great students of the Constitution, one being my fellow apostle, Elder Dallin H. Oaks. He recently spoke here in Provo while most of you students were away during the summer. He cited five inspired fundamentals of that document. First, the separation of powers in the three branches of government. The division of powers between the states and federal government. Third, the Bill of Rights. Fourth, the principle of popular sovereignty. And fifth and finally, there is divine inspiration in the fundamental underlying premise of our whole constitutional order. So it is the rule of law and not of man that governs it. All of the blessings we enjoy under the United States Constitution are dependent upon the rule of law. That is why President J. Reuben Clark said, "Our allegiance runs to the Constitution and its principles which it embodies, and not to individuals. The rule of law is the basis of liberty." Concerning the fourth of these great, truly divine principles, inspired by the fundamentals, is that of the sovereignty of the people. Elder Oaks also said, "Perhaps the most important and greatest fundamental of our inspired Constitution is the principle of popular sovereignty. The people are the source of government power. Along with many religious people, Latter-day Saints affirm that God gave the power to the people, and the people consented to a constitution that delegated certain powers to the government. Sovereignty is not inherent in a state or nation just because it has power that comes from armed forces. Sovereignty does not come from the divine right of a king who grants his subjects such power as he pleases or is forced to concede, such as in the Magna Carta. The sovereign power is in the people. I believe this is one of the great meanings in the Revelation, which tells us that God established the Constitution of the United States, that every man may act according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be under bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the Constitution of this land." In other words, the most desirable condition for the effective exercise of God-given moral agency is a condition of maximum freedom and responsibility. In this condition, men are accountable for their own sins and cannot blame their political condition or their bondage on a king or a tyrant. This condition is achieved when the people are sovereign, as they are under the Constitution God established for our nation. For this follows that the most important words in the United States Constitution are the words in the preamble: "We, the people of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution." President Benson expressed the fundamental principle of popular sovereignty when he said, "We, the people, are superior to government and should remain masters over it, not the other way around." The Book of Mormon explains this principle in these words: "An unrighteous king doth pervert the ways of all righteousness. Therefore choose you by the voice of the people judges, that ye may be judged according to the laws." Now it is not common that the voice of the people desireth anything contrary to that which is right, but it is common for the lesser part of the people to desire that which is not right. "Therefore this yet shall ye observe, and make it your law, to do your business by the voice of the people." Popular sovereignty necessarily implies popular responsibility. Instead of blaming troubles on kings and other sovereigns, all citizens must share the burden and responsibility of governing. As the Book of Mormon teaches us, burdens should come upon all people, that every man might bear his part. As a nation, we have been showered with numerous blessings that have been a direct result of our Constitution. Unfortunately, many of us have forgotten that with the receipt of such blessings also comes that responsibility. Probably the most important responsibility is that we ensure the continuance of freedoms that we have received for our children and for our grandchildren. We cannot do that from the sidelines. Patriotism is not a spectator sport. We must become involved in the process of freedom. Wherefore, honest and wise men should be sought for diligently, and good men and wise men ye should observe to uphold. Further, we need to understand the great principles of the founding documents. How can we befriend that law, which is constitutional law of the land, if we are not familiar with it and its genesis? We need to drink deeply at the wellspring of this great document. We must also recognize that, as President John Adams said, we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and religion. We are facing this situation to a degree in the world today. Therefore, we have the responsibility to remain unspotted from the world, to be upright and honest in all of our dealings, and to set the example for that which we have been given. Francis Grund wrote, "The American Constitution is remarkable for its simplicity, but it can only suffice a people habitually correct in their actions and would be utterly inadequate to the wants of a different nation. Change in the domestic habits of Americans, their religious devotion, and their high respect for morality, and it will not be necessary to change a single word in the Constitution in order to vary the whole form of their government." As Latter-day Saints, we should take heart what the late President David O. McKay counseled. Next to being one in worshiping God, there is nothing in this world upon which the Church should be more united than in upholding the Constitution of the United States. We as a people have been the recipients of some of God's most choice blessings, and I believe they came only as a result of the dedication and sacrifice of our forefathers. We need at this time and in this place to follow the counsel of yet another great American, Abraham Lincoln, when he said, "Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity support the Constitution. Let it be taught in the schools, in seminaries and colleges. Let it be written in the primers, in the spelling books, and in the almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpits, proclaimed in legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. In short, let it become the political religion of the nation, and in particular, establish a reverence for the Constitution." Now, I love this great land of the free. It has always been with a feeling of pride within my very soul when the flag passes by. I was taught this as a young child, when Dad would always make us get out of the car when the American flag would pass by in a parade. This feeling has only increased over the years as I have stood as a young Boy Scout early in the morning at flag-raising ceremonies and throughout the years attending school and pledging allegiance to her before starting each day's schoolwork. Yes, and there have even been times on foreign soil, after the battle is over, when in dirty dungarees with a rifle in hand, I have stood and saluted our flag as it was raised to the top of a handmade flagpole. Oh, this be it ever, when free men shall stand between their loved homes and war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven's rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just. And this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. May God bless each of us with the desire to gain a real understanding of the blessings granted to us under this great Constitution of the United States of America, and have the strength and the courage to defend and uphold it for our generation and all who will follow after us, is my humble prayer in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.